Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump is in Dayton, Ohio at this hour. He'll travel through El Paso, Texas later today to meet with victims of and first responders to the mass shootings in both cities. The president spoke as he left the White House about possible gun legislation, saying he was looking to do background checks, though he said he wouldn't call for an assault weapons ban. He also spoke of a possible congressional move on so-called red flag laws, which many states already have. This is the ability to ask a judge to order guns be temporarily removed from people who might hurt themselves or others.
I think there's a great appetite to do something with regard to making sure that mentally unstable, seriously ill people aren't carrying guns. And I've never seen the appetite as strong as it is now. I have not seen it with regard to certain types of weapons.
This from the president despite rolling back an Obama-era regulation that did make it more difficult for mentally ill people to obtain guns. Meanwhile, there are questions about the mental health of the 24-year-old who was shot and killed by Dayton police during his shooting rampage in which he killed 9 and injured 27 in Dayton. Why, people are asking, wasn't he flagged? Some say they tried. Will Garby is covering the story for the Dayton Daily News. Will, you paint a disturbing picture. And a warning, some listeners may not want to hear this, but you spoke to many former classmates of the shooter, including a woman who approached the police nearly a decade ago about her concerns. She had a conversation when they were both much younger. He talked about having fantasies of wanting to tie her up and cut her up. What did she tell you?
Yeah, we had it was a pretty disturbing interview with a classmate of his all the way back from middle school and in high school. And she said to us, and this really fits with what a lot of his high school and middle school classmates have said, is this idea that this shooter, this killer, was kind of obsessed with death and had a hit list and had told this girl in particular that he had wanted to slit her throat and was also sexually attracted to her. She went so far as to say that she had even reported to police with her parents that this had happened. Police have told us that they have really no records of this, and it's not clear if that's because records have been expunged or if, you know, retention schedules have already cleared those records out. The one thing that I found particularly sad about what this young woman had told us was that the shooter had told her he was afraid of his own thoughts and afraid of what he might do.
Well, you know, crying out for help. And what there is no question about is that the shooter was suspended his senior year from Bellbrook High School for making that list of girls he wanted to kill. A police officer came on the school bus, according to other students, took him off the bus. He was suspended. He also caused a lockdown at another time after writing a hit list on a bathroom wall. Do we know that after these incidents in high school, he ever got, during these suspensions, any kind of mandatory health care?
No, we don't know that. We and others have requested student records and disciplinary records from the school district.
Well, you also found evidence that the shooter was planning this attack or something similar as recently as 5 months ago. You requested police phone logs. What'd you find? Who'd you talk to?
Yeah, so we requested a log from the Bellbrook Police Department, and that log showed phone calls from inside the home and phone calls from people who knew the shooter. And one of those individuals we spoke with, the shooter at one point apparently pulled out a gun, stuck it to this kid's head, and kind of joked, you know, like, I could blow your brains out right now. And the kid we interviewed, his name is also Will, kind of played it off as a joke. But later on, going out to bars with this shooter, had spoken really in the hypothetical about, you know, I could really do some damage here.
You know, equally disturbing is that the Dayton shooter, again, who killed 9 people over the weekend, he was also seen at a protest against a KKK rally and carrying a gun somewhat like the one he used in the Dayton shooting. Now, there's been a lot of debate as to which side of the political spectrum he might have been on. In this case, he was protesting against the KKK.
Right. We have a reporter within our organization who knew this individual and recognized him, and wasn't until this happened that, the reporter said, well, yeah, I saw him at the KKK rally.
Your newspaper also purchased a background check of the shooter's social media history and found postings of somewhat illegible writing, but the captions said things like, all shall be annihilated, bloodlust, absolute carnage, bloody massacre. It feels as if this was just somebody obsessed with killing.
Yeah, kind of an odd fascination with death, with killing. Those posts, as far as we can tell, those were MySpace posts dating back probably a decade, if that is any indication that this was a lasting interest of his. Mm-hmm. That's probably the case based off our reporting.
That's Will Garby, and he's reporting for the Dayton Daily News. We'll link you at herenow.org. It's so disturbing but revealing. Will, thank you.
Thank you.
And we will continue to follow the news today in Dayton and El Paso, elsewhere in the show. But now to some other news. Congress made hemp legal across the country last year. It's a plant that's very similar to marijuana, but hemp has less THC, which is the chemical that makes you high. Hemp is used to make products such as clothes, animal feed, and these days, CBD. Federal agencies are still working on regulations, but some states already allow farmers to grow hemp. And as Madeline Beck reports, this comes with plenty of risks.
Soggy crops, seed fraud, and uncertainty. Those are only a few of the challenges facing the nation's blooming hemp industry.
I started getting questions like crazy. It was all over the place, my emails, my phone.
That's Philip Alberti with the University of Illinois Extension. Illinois is joining other states, including Oregon, Colorado, and Pennsylvania, in licensing hemp growing this year. More than 500 producers in Illinois alone are okay to plant more than 13,000 acres. Hemp is a hardy plant, but Alberti says the Midwest's torrential rains were brutal.
Hemp likes water, but it doesn't like wet feet. And, this year has been, for the most part, unprecedented.
Add to that faulty seeds. Farmers around the state have reported getting seeds that don't germinate well or aren't what they ordered. And those seeds can easily cost more than $10,000 a pound, generally shipped from Colorado, Canada, or Europe. If seeds all sprout, it can fetch a pretty penny as fibers for clothes or industrial materials, grains for food, or CBD, an oil popularized for many health benefits, proven or not. For hemp growers in Illinois, Alberti says,
I think it's safe to assume north than 90-95% of those applications were with the intent of doing it for CBD.
But while CBD's market has skyrocketed, it's hard to build an industry on a crop that hasn't been produced in the U.S. for decades. Hemp machinery and production facilities can be hard to come by. Take it from Jeff Whaling, chairman of the National Hemp Association, who helped to legalize hemp growing.
There is no harvesting equipment. There isn't a huge seed supply. There is no decortication facilities, which are necessary components to tear this crop apart into its raw components.
He says there are small processors out there, but overall, Whaling cautions farmers to have a buyer before they risk everything on a crop that has insufficient insurance options, few bank and lending options, and no real guarantees.
I would hate to see farmers wanting to jump into hemp and there not be a marketplace. So, be cautioned, buyer beware are words that I use continuously as we move forward.
Consider this. If a farmer grows hemp for CBD, they need female plants only, which produce CBD-infused flowers. If male plants come along, either from a mixed seed batch or from a neighboring hemp field, they'll pollinate the flower and ruin the crop.
Pollen from hemp can drift as far as 7, 10, some say as far as 20 miles.
And we don't know how certain hemp varieties behave in different climates. If it makes too much THC, the plant will have to be destroyed. That's considered marijuana. So Whaling wants the U.S. Department of Agriculture to take several things into account while coming up with federal hemp rules expected next year, like seed regulation, growing transparency, interstate commerce rules, banking issues. But some hemp growers in Illinois have already had luck. In the western part of the state, Andy Houston had a greenhouse with 90,000 hemp seedlings to be planted across a few nearby acres.
there's a strong possibility that you could grow somewhere between $20,000 and $55,000 an acre off of hemp.
Houston is a sixth-generation farmer, and he's one of the few people in Illinois who grew hemp last year as a research test pilot. From that crop, he had seeds to sell this year. And he got experience to share with farmers he works with. He even bought his own CBD extraction machine to process in-house.
With the acres that we have, it should keep our oil extractor going for 12 months.
Like many others, Houston had to harvest it by hand last year. But he's trying a disc mower this year, something used in hay, and trying to limit weeds. Without approved pesticides, hemp has to be grown organically. So while Houston's hemp has been doing well, he's still growing corn and soybeans, and still figuring things out.
I think I will probably be learning about hemp for the rest of my life, but that's what makes it pretty interesting.
But farming is just the beginning of a new hemp industry in the United States. It won't skyrocket overnight, but expect more hemp products from lip balms to plastic to hit the shelves in the coming months and years. For Here and Now, I'm Madeline Beck.
And Madeline reported the story for Harvest Public Media.
Here and Now is supported by Daily Harvest. Daily Harvest delivers carefully sourced, chef-crafted smoothies, soups, harvest bowls, overnight oats, and more, all built on fruits and vegetables. Each single-serving cup can be prepared in minutes. Daily Harvest is designed for convenience, so you can load up on fruits and vegetables first thing in the morning, before bed, and any time in between. Learn more about Daily Harvest and get 3 free cups in your first box when you go to dailyharvest.com and use promo code NOW. That's dailyharvest.com. Use promo code NOW.
According to the Department of Veterans Affairs, between 11 and 20% of vets of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, in a given year. We're going to spend the next 2 days hearing from two vets who fall into that category. Fidel Gomez-Torres served in the Navy. He's with me in the studio. Fidel, welcome.
Thank you.
And we're also joined by Isaiah James, who's an Army veteran. He's in New York. Isaiah, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And let me start with both of you. And first of all, thank you both for your service. Isaiah, let me start with you. Tell me about your military service. You were deployed 3 times.
Yes, I was deployed to Iraq 2 times and Afghanistan 1 time. My job in the Army was an 11 Bravo, which is an infantryman. My first deployment was 15 months from October 06 to January 08. My second deployment was December 08 to December 2009. And my final deployment was June 2010 to May 2011. I was wounded in service. I loved being in the Army, but not for the reasons you would think. I loved the kinship and the camaraderie and the brotherhood that it provided. And once I got hurt, I couldn't do it anymore. So the Army medically retired me. So at 27 years old, I was literally a retiree. And that's when all the problems hit me, when one day I was in the service and the next day, literally the next day, I was just a civilian out on my own.
And that's when you started to deal with PTSD right away?
Yes. I didn't really deal with it while I was in, because you're surrounded by, like, everybody's going through the same things. So you don't really want to manifest your problems on anybody else. But it's when you get outside the military and the civilian world is a lot different, and you're on your own and you don't really have that support network there. And that's when, for me, that's when all the problems started.
Fidel, what about you? Tell me about your service in the Navy.
I joined in 2008. I had one deployment to Afghanistan. I spent 10 months in Kandahar. The deployment included a leg before and after, so total deployment time was 15 months. I was a builder, so I was attached to a construction battalion. Much of the work that we were doing in Kandahar was expanding the airfield, building some facilities, expanding the facilities there. And I came back in 2011. I absolutely enjoyed my time deployed. I enjoyed my time in the Navy. In terms of when my PTSD started manifesting itself, it took me a really long time to give it a name. And I think that for me, I was just having a hard time when I returned adjusting. And, you know, I was living in New York City at that time. New York City could be a very overwhelming city. I felt overly stimulated by everything that was going on. And I started to realize that I carried a lot of anger. It would really bother me when people would complain about how hot the subway was. Because I would always reference it back to where I had just came from. So everything was always connected to where I had just came from. And in my head at that time, no one had any reason to complain about anything. But of course, that's not the case. You know, sometimes we have bad days, people complain about it. So for me, I started noticing it in terms of my temperament, my anger. I was very quick to get upset and annoyed. And, you know, it wasn't until last year when I actually started seeking treatment. So almost an 8-year journey to finally figuring out this is what it is. It's okay. This is what I need to do in order to make it better.
Isaiah, when you hear Fidel talk about that in New York City, and you're in New York now, do you have that same issue, just the overwhelming nature of a city, or maybe people complaining about things that seem trivial to you?
Yes, absolutely. But I do have to remember that I am in the civilian world now, because one thing, my wife, my lovely, lovely wife, we'll go outside and she'll be like, it's hot. And I can remember back to the days of my first deployment, literally it was 130 degrees outside and we were going on 8-hour foot patrols. So yes, and I always call, you know, our problems first world problems. But yes, New York City can be a very overstimulating place. And I speak to the fact that I do my therapy at the VA near my house, and it's helped me get over being in New York City a lot. And spending time with my wife is probably my main therapeutic thing.
How else has PTSD manifested itself for you, Isaiah?
Mine was really severe. Mine was really, really bad. I would snap on anybody for any little thing. And I'm a big guy. I'm 6'8". I'm 300 pounds. So I'm a very large individual. So I would literally sit at home at night and just sit up all night staring in the darkness, waiting for somebody to come through a door that wasn't coming through a door. When I knew I needed help was when I was younger, and I was sitting in my bathroom on the floor with a giant bottle of scotch and a bottle of sleeping pills and just crying uncontrollably, not wanting to be here anymore, not wanting to live with this anymore, because I have seen so much pain and so much death and destruction throughout my deployments. And this little voice inside my head just said, you can't give up. So that's when I started seeking help, and it literally has saved my life.
Did you ever, Fidel, think about suicide?
No.
And Isaiah, after that happened, when you were in your bathroom with scotch and pills, have you ever had that happen again?
No.
So let's talk about how each of you managed to get help, or when you decided to get help. Fidel, I'll start with you.
After returning from my deployment, we were told that we should go to the VA, register with the VA, get an evaluation. And a lot of my friends were going, and they were being diagnosed with PTSD and TBI. And I felt fearful of going and getting diagnosed.
Why?
Well, I feel like there was such a stigma, and still is, around having PTSD. There is this idea of brokenness that you carry. And for me, I've always been high functioning. I've always been an overachiever. And the idea that something had changed fundamentally, and that I could no longer be the person that I've always known myself and had pride, you know, took pride in being, made me very afraid. It made me feel that a diagnosis could redefine me. And would redefine me. So I was very stubborn and I was very resistant. Nevertheless, I still saw the symptoms. And deep inside, whenever I allowed myself to be honest, I would tell myself, I keep on saying I'm okay, but I don't think that I am. I would really just kind of secretly deal with it, but I could tell that it was affecting those around me. At that time, I was in a relationship. The relationship, you know, kind of just went down south. I was having a lot of trouble sleeping. I was having extreme nightmares. I was sleepwalking. I was having sleep paralysis. Because I wasn't getting sleep, I was walking around very temperamental and angry and exhausted, and carrying just a lot of anxiety. And I kept on telling myself, you know, I'm okay. You know, it's just today. I didn't sleep last night. I wasn't asking myself, well, why didn't you sleep last night? I knew that I didn't sleep, and I knew that if I continued to ask myself questions, I would end up going back to like, well, you're not okay. But I needed to be okay. So I needed to tell the people around me, and I needed to believe it. So for the longest time, I resisted. But, you know, the symptoms just became something that I ended up normalizing until I realized that because I had not sought help and because I had not tried to heal, what I was afraid of in the diagnosis had already happened without it. And it was this idea that you're not the same person. Something is broken and you keep on ignoring it. You're not going to get better and you're not ever going to be the person that you were unless you start fixing whatever is broken.
Isaiah, what about you? What made you decide to get help?
Like I referenced before, it was that story I told you. Mm-hmm. That next day I went to my local VA and I walked in, and now most VAs have a section that's for older veterans and for Operation Iraqi Freedom, Operation Enduring Freedom veterans. So I went to that section for the younger veterans. I was scared. I was like, I don't want to be seen as somebody who society might look down upon because I'm dealing with this mental issue. And they were so welcoming and receptive. And the stigma that I thought would be there wasn't there. The barriers that I thought would be there weren't there. And I started dealing with my caseworker and I started going to group therapy. Group therapy for me, at first they put me into group therapy with a lot of older veterans who from the Vietnam and Korea era. But I didn't really connect with those veterans' stories and their experiences. I mean, the trauma of war is such that we all connect, but I needed to connect with younger veterans. So then I started going to counseling with younger veterans who shared my same job in the military. And then I realized that I'm not alone in this fight, that people are dealing with this who, for any other all intents and purposes, look quote-unquote normal, but are dealing with these issues on the inside. And I was so relieved that I didn't have this albatross around my neck anymore weighing me down. Mm-hmm. Because as Fidel was saying, like not sleeping and the sleep paralysis, I know exactly what he's talking about because I still don't sleep to this day. I still, when I walk into my apartment, you know, I have to check the bathroom and the closets to make sure nobody's in there. I know nobody's in there, but my mind won't turn off all completely from that hypervigilance. So I'm still dealing with it, but it's not as bad as it used to be a few years ago.
It's Army veteran Isaiah James. We're also speaking with Navy veteran Fidel Gomez-Torres about their experiences with PTSD. Tomorrow, we'll talk about their experiences getting treatment. If you are a veteran and want to share your experience with PTSD, do it at hereandnow.org.
Last week in Southern California, we had a terrible reminder that that state's soaring coastline cliffs see constant violent change. A woman celebrating her victory over breast cancer was one of three people in her family killed when a slab of sandstone from the cliffs towering above fell on them at a beach in Encinitas. Horrible, but not unheard of. These cliffs naturally erode, and climate change and rising seas can make the problem much worse. Dr. Patrick Barnard is a researcher at the U.S. Geological Survey. Dr. Barnard, Patrick, you say people need to be aware that cliffs erode. People also stand on top of them and die when they've collapsed underneath them. Remind us why. What's the geology here?
Well, cliff failures are a natural process. It's part of our dynamic coast. Landslides occur. That's the very nature of cliffs and why they're shaped the way they are. So this is something that's happened throughout time and a process, however, that is certainly exacerbated by the modifications we've made to our coastal system and to our climate.
But you wrote in a USGS study last year that Southern California shorelines could recede in some cases by more than 167 feet by the end of the century. A Washington Post writer had a beautiful description. He said, like an axe slowly chopping at the trunk of a massive tree, waves driven by sea level rise are hacking away at the bases of these cliffs?
Yeah, I mean, there are many factors that drive the retreat of cliffs, but one of them is certainly the amount of time that the ocean hammers away at the base of the cliff. So as sea level rises, that time is going to increase, and therefore the frequency and magnitude of these types of cliff failures is expected to increase dramatically as sea level continues to accelerate over the next century.
You've described it as something like 30 million dump trucks full of material that will be eroded from the cliffs. So what should happen here? People are talking about, you know, maybe shutting off beaches. What needs to happen?
Well, I think we just need to exercise caution. You know, we've seen beaches thinning over time, especially the last several decades in areas like northern San Diego County. And, you know, those beaches are the first line of defense at protecting the base of the cliffs. And so if we have thinner beaches, we're going to have more waves pounding the base of the cliffs. We're going to have more cliff failure. So we need to just exercise more caution when we are, you know, living in these kinds of environments. We need to steer away from the bases of these cliffs. We shouldn't be setting up our beach chairs, unfortunately, right at the bottom of these walls and in these very hazardous areas.
Well, the safety of beachgoers or people peering over the edge is one thing, but people live on these cliffs. There's railroads just a little bit inland. There's, you know, roads. Is there any way to shore them up, or is your sense that people should be planning to move back?
Well, cliffs are certainly hazardous environments, and we've overdeveloped the tops of these cliffs for sure. There's thousands and thousands of clifftop homes throughout Southern California. And new development now is being asked to, you know, provide a reasonable setback from the edge of these cliffs because their failure is very hard to predict. It's very sporadic. You know, in California cliffs, for example, retreat about a foot a year, but you may have in one particular location nothing that occurs for 20 years and you'll have 20 feet of retreat. So setbacks really need to be implemented so we can provide for the safety of our communities.
That's U.S. Geological Survey research geologist Dr. Patrick Barnard speaking to us from California about the cliff failures there, one very tragic one recently. Patrick, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
The National Rifle Association, the powerhouse gun lobby that's had a firm hand in guiding and curtailing gun legislation in the U.S., is on the defense after two mass shootings and months of intra-organization turmoil. Yesterday, the NRA tweeted out that anti-gun politicians blame us for crimes we don't commit, fending off critics. But the NRA is also arm wrestling itself over leadership, questions about its tax-exempt status, finances. Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal says the organization is imploding. Carol Lenig is national investigative reporter for The Washington Post. Hi, Carol.
Hey, Robin. How are you?
I'm good. And you've been reporting a lot on this, including your report yesterday that the NRA, which is again tax-exempt, planned to buy a $6 million mansion for its biggest star, Chief Executive Wayne LaPierre. Let's just do a thumbnail here. In April, LaPierre accused the group's president, Oliver North, of trying to oust him. In June, the group ended its relationship with longtime ad company Ackerman McQueen and NRA spokeswoman Dana Loesch, and it shut down NRA TV. So start with North and LaPierre and the accusations they were lobbing at each other.
Well, it got pretty ugly, and it was a bloody family feud, to be honest, Robin. Mm-hmm. What was happening behind the scenes before the NRA's national convention is that Oliver North, probably best known as a famous aide in the Iran-Contra scandal under President Reagan, he was the formal president of the NRA, and he was raising questions with fellow board members about a lot of spending behind the scenes at the NRA. The thing he was most concerned about at the time were tens of millions of dollars in legal fees that were being billed to the NRA by a law firm run by Bill Brewer out of New York and Texas. He said that those fees represented an existential threat to the NRA, which was then close to running its third year in a deficit. When he raised those concerns with board members and asked the audit committee and the executive committee to look into these threats, these expenses, and what in the world they were for, roughly, you know, $100,000 a day in legal fees, Wayne LaPierre came at him with guns blazing, and no pun intended, and said, you know, there's a problem. Oliver North is trying a coup to get rid of me. He's blackmailing me. And he's also at the trough trying to get money from the NRA through our ad firm in a very lucrative contract. And we need to get rid of him.
I'm going to jump in there because this ad firm was reportedly making a documentary and paying North, this is what LaPierre says, paying North millions. And this advertising firm, which did most of its business, was the NRA, was then fired. But, you know, when you talk about LaPierre spending, there was also $200,000 in clothing to an NRA vendor, and then this $6 million mansion in Dallas. The New York Attorney General is looking at that mansion as part of its investigation into whether the NRA should remain tax exempt. But just quickly, did you ever find out what that legal fee was?
Well, it's we know that it was $24 million last year over the course of a year. Forgive me. Mm-hmm. We don't know what that legal fee entails. For example, it could involve media managing, messaging, consulting, investigations, forensic accounting. But that was the rough amount of the bill. The big question about these legal fees, as described to us by NRA insiders, is how in the world they could be justified. Now, it's true that Wayne LaPierre is under investigation by two different entities now, New York and the D.C. Attorney General, who has subpoenaed also records from the NRA about financial transactions. I've talked to some of the best white-collar law firms and lawyers who are nationally known for their work, and they are absolutely flabbergasted by this fee and say there is no way that they could ever reach a number of $100,000 a day in legal fees, even if they were in trial for a multinational corporation.
So that smells. But then there's also shutting down NRA TV, firing Dana Loesch, a spokeswoman, because the NRA was actually concerned that NRA TV was going too far to the right, off NRA talking points, talking about things like immigration. Dana Loesch at one point putting KKK hoods on children's toy trains. So they jettisoned that. But where would you say the NRA is now in public support, in donations, in membership?
Well, you know, we've been covering at the Washington Post the NRA for decades. And I, more recently, still, you know, 5 or 10 years. And I have never seen anything like this in the fissures of longtime, devoted, dedicated NRA members, board members, donors, supporters, all throwing up their hands and saying that there's something rotten in Denmark. There was quite a large cabal of people who were calling for Wayne LaPierre's forgive me, his ouster and wanting Chris Cox, who is fairly beloved as a congressional whisperer, if you will, and lobbyist behind the scenes for the NRA, calling for him to be the new president rather than Wayne. There is a lot of anxiety, and I've never seen anything like it. Yeah. And I think part of it goes, Robin, to this point about the nonprofit status. Yeah. If the NRA loses that, it loses everything.
Right. Well, how would you characterize this moment when it comes to Republicans, including the president? President Trump once criticized the NRA after the Florida Parkland shootings. We remember he was calling for taking away guns from dangerous people without due process. He mused about banning assault rifles. He derided a fellow Republican for being afraid of the NRA. He said, "I'm not afraid." Then he met with the group, reversed all of his stances. This week, the NRA said it welcomed the president's comments about mental illness as opposed to guns being the problem. But then we're hearing the president say today, you know, maybe we do need to see more background checks, more red flags. You're seeing Republicans like Senator Lindsey Graham working on legislation to give states incentives to pass those so-called red flags. You've got Illinois Congressman Adam Kinzinger proposing raising the gun purchase age to 21. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine asking for better background checks. Yesterday, Mike Turner of the Dayton area Republican congressman came out in favor of a ban on military-style weapons. Do you get the sense that Republicans are smelling maybe a wounded animal in the NRA?
They're definitely a wounded animal. There's no question about that. I think what's interesting about this, Robin, and you laid it out so well, is the president is in a vice grip right now. He is being roundly blamed, essentially, as inciting the violence that led to one of these shootings. The manifesto of the shooter in El Paso so dramatically overlaps with the president's own language. So he's taking some heat. Is he responsible for the, you know, for at least encouraging, enabling, or creating an environment that enabled this? On the other hand, I think he's definitely trying to size up how important and powerful is the NRA still? They've always been a juggernaut when it came to Republicans seeking reelection. And this is a president who's seeking reelection. He's got to be figuring out, how powerful are they to me? Or is this wounded animal something that I don't have to worry about anymore?
Well, what do you think the answer is? You know, as to membership and, you know, donations, what do you think the answer is?
I think that there's going to be – I think the situation for the NRA is going to get a lot worse before it gets better. These investigations are heating up, not slowing down. The revelations that are coming out, including the one that we broke yesterday about this mansion, $6 million, members rightfully are starting to raise their pitchforks and say, who is this leader and where has he been leading us? Why has he been telling us he needs our $25 donations urgently to protect the mission of the Second Amendment? At the same time, he's going for inspection tours in a lakefront golf course community, French Chateau. I think it's going to be much worse. As for a wounded animal, we'll see how powerful it is politically. But without Chris Cox, without this rock solid group of members of support, I think that's a very serious problem.
Well, but Ken, and Christopher Cox, again, sort of the second in command, who, as you said, was the congressional whisperer who kept Republican lawmakers in line. He's jettisoned because Wayne LaPierre felt he was part of the coup plot orchestrated by Oliver North. This is a movie. But do you think if Wayne LaPierre is ousted, things will change? Briefly.
Right now, I think the only thing the NRA is, other than people who care deeply about Second Amendment rights, is
Wayne LaPierre.
Yeah. I think that is it. It is becoming a shell.
That's Carol Lenick, national investigative reporter for The Washington Post. Carol, thank you so much.
Of course.
And we'd love listeners' thoughts at hereandnow.org.
Stocks tumbled again this morning amid new worries about a global economic slowdown connected to the escalating trade dispute between China and the United States. One of the economists who has been sounding the alarm about what he calls a growing risk of recession is Larry Summers, former Treasury Secretary and former Director of the National Economic Council. He's also President Emeritus of Harvard University and joins us now. Larry Summers, welcome back to Here and Now.
Glad to be with you, Jeremy.
So you tweeted this week that we may well be at the most dangerous financial moment since the 2009 financial crisis because of the situation with China. Expand on that. Are you saying that the trade war could trigger a recession or even a financial crisis?
I'm certainly saying that the risks of recession now look to be larger than at any time since the last recession. I say that because the expansion has been going for a long time, because a variety of economic indicators of industrial production and other things have shown some slippage. A tremendous amount of uncertainty is being introduced because of the Chinese conflict that had added to it uncertainty with the president's claims that the Chinese currency was manipulated, and because the single best indicator of future recession, the so-called slope of the yield curve, whether long-term interest rates are higher or lower than short-term interest rates, right now they're lower, which has historically been a sign that a recession was likely to come.
So you don't think that China is a currency manipulator? You criticize the administration for saying that.
I think the suggestion's absurd. Currency manipulators are pushing their currency down. China is intervening in the market to hold its currency up. Currency manipulators are running large surpluses with respect to the world. China is in balance with respect to the world and has moved its trade position in a way that favors the rest of the world by a massive amount in recent years. So China was a manipulator 25 years ago when the Clinton Treasury declared it to be a manipulator. You could have made a reasonable argument when the Obama Treasury threatened to declare it a manipulator that they were engaged in questionable practices. But now with the surplus eliminated and their interventions being to buy their currency rather than sell their currency, it's an absurdity.
What do you think that the U.S. should do right now to bring this trade war to an end?
We should reach an agreement. We should stop engaging in these sadomasochistic policies where the debate is about whether our sadism to them is going to be better or worse than our masochism to ourselves. We should get the agreement that we can, and we should focus on what's most important, which is what we do to strengthen our own economy.
President Trump today tweeted, "Our problem is a Federal Reserve that is too proud to admit their mistake of acting too fast and tightening too much." He wants the Fed to lower rates even more than it already has. Yesterday, four former Fed chairs signed an open letter calling on the president to stop criticizing the central bank. It doesn't seem like he's taking that advice, but what do you think about what the Fed should do and this whole argument about the Fed maintaining its independence from the White House?
I think the Fed should and likely will reduce rates over the course of the next half year. I think the president, ironically, makes it harder for them. Any central bank, to preserve its credibility, has to look like and be like it's making its decisions on the economic fundamentals, not on the political pressures. And so when the president engages in such overt and extensive political pressure, it almost forces the Fed to demonstrate its independence by not appearing overly responsive. So I expect we'll have higher interest rates because of what the president's doing, not lower interest rates.
I want to ask you about one more thing. You told the BBC that the UK will struggle to strike a trade deal with the US after Britain leaves the European Union. This is one of the things that the British have been talking about doing. Do you think that Britain will leave the EU at the end of October as they're on schedule to do right now? And what about the future relationship between the UK and the US?
I think the British will probably leave. On just what terms, I don't know, and I'm not certain. The US is a massive market for Britain. Britain is a relatively minor market for the United States. That just means that all the issues of US-UK trade are not going to get nearly as much attention from the United States, given everything else that's going on, as the British hope. That's why I think any idea in Britain that EU departure is okay because of the relationship they're going to have with the United States is a very problematic one.
That is Larry Summers, former Treasury Secretary and President Emeritus at Harvard University. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
Good to be with you, Jeremy.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.